How long can it persist when the whole world is on fear? And what we're seeing now are the small nations who've got nothing to lose, back to the war with IMF, and they can take these risky bets. Certainly, if you're the US, you're not going to take the risky bet, right? Because you've got everything to lose.
This week, we are talking about a once in 150-year event, the adoption of Bitcoin as a global macro asset, with two of the world's foremost leaders in Bitcoin on-chain analytics, co-founder of SwissBlock, Jan Allman, and the one and only Willy Wu. This was a conversation diving deep into what the metrics tell us today about the current state of Bitcoin adoption and where we are in the present cycle, and how we can think about the coming 5, 10, 15, and 20 years of the future of Bitcoin's maturation as a global asset. I learned a lot listening to these guys talk and enjoyed it tremendously, and I hope you do as well. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. This week, we are joined by two special guests, pioneers in the on-chain analytics space in Bitcoin, Jan Allman and Willy Wu. Fellas, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Scott. Been looking forward to this.
So, I guess lots of places where we could go at the start as we get going. Willy, I wanted to ask you about a tweet that you actually put out yesterday talking about Bitcoin's opportunity to be measured in terms of achieving 50% of global GDP. And, you know, there's a bigger question here, I guess, around how we should be thinking about Bitcoin. So you guys are measuring it and sort of micro level, you know, cutting up all kinds of detail, but you've also got this really big sort of long-term macro view. And, so for our listeners, you know, what does a Bitcoin's possibility of attaining 50% of global GDP. How does somebody even think about what that means?
That's kind of a long range view. And, you know, if we're talking about global macro and what Bitcoin is, that's probably something I'd hand off to Jan, because he's much more of an expert on that. And he can give an introduction of his work and his background before diving into what his research has done. But, that tweet started off with everyone giving price targets, and it's a bit crazy to put out a price target, right? Because you're price targeting in a currency that's debasing by a factor of 8%, 7-8% per year, depending on how you measure it, 5% growth in the amount of fiat in the world each year. And then you've got, you know, the sort of increase in GDP each year. So everything's a moving sort of, everything's a moving target. And so when you say, you know, for example, Plan B will have on his hand 100 trillion USD, basically, and that's like a target. But the question is, when do you hit that target, right? Do we hit it, you know, in 10 years? Do we hit in 100 years? What is $100 trillion worth in 100 years, right? So it's kind of meaningless. So I wanted to bring into this target something that's a little bit more real and capture it into something, you know, the whole economy is based on, which is the amount of goods and services that's pumped out, right? And so let's measure it as a percentage of that as a yardstick, which is constantly growing or contracting according to, you know, our technology levels, how much time we have and you know, what year it is. So we know that Bitcoin reaches saturation at a particular target. Right now, we're hockey sticking up into an adoption. It'll taper off once it gets to saturation. It's an S curve. Gold is basically had 6,000 years, so it's at saturation. We're in there's an asset that's sort of maybe 5-10% adopted, right? At most, probably 5%, I think. And so where do we get to? What will it be when it's at full adoption? And so if you look at money, right? Money is generally the same size as world GDP. They're kind of a lockstep because it's half of everything. The money is paying for the goods and services, and they tend to grow together. And so say if Bitcoin reaches that kind of, you know, reserve currency level, then maybe we can use that as a metric. Maybe it's half of everything and it's basically world GDP 1-to-1. But then I actually see plus or minus 50% of that. Because maybe it doesn't get money. Maybe it backs some of the money. Maybe we still have like fiat notes floating around. Or maybe we grab other markets. We grab real estate. We get store of value in, you know, things like equity, bond markets, real estate, and so forth. And, you know, that is, depending on how you measure it, $700 to $900 trillion in, you know, today's dollars. And if you were to say, what is that really? Well, that's not real because, for example, MicroStrategy is stacking Bitcoin. And then it's also counted back again. We count the market cap of Bitcoin and we count the S&P 500, right? Or all global equities. You're counting it twice. You can't do that, right? So same thing with real estate. Real estate is very illiquid. And whereas Bitcoin is deep liquidity. So as soon as these real estate investors start to sell their real estate and then buy Bitcoin, well, Bitcoin's not going to swell to the same amount of market cap that real estate loss because real estate's a liquid, so it's going to collapse a lot. It's a little bit like if all the altcoins in the world were sold tomorrow, right? And let's say, I don't know what the altcoin market cap is, let's say it's 1.5 trillion, and that all went into Bitcoin. Well, what does Bitcoin's market cap grow by? It's not going to grow by 1.5 trillion, I'll tell you, because the liquidity in Bitcoin is so deep and the altcoin market is so thin that the collapse on one side is way smaller than way bigger than the growth on the Bitcoin side. So I give it a plus 50%, you know, on the capture of other assets because even though it might eat up, say, you know, if real estate is 250 trillion, say, and it captures 50 trillion of that, I don't think that, you know, Bitcoin grows by 50 trillion. It's not one to one. There's liquidity dynamics. So that's all I wanted to say is like, look at the end goal. Maybe it takes us 20 years to get there. And what is that at saturation? I think the world economy's GDP is a very good yardstick.
And so, you know, you mentioned like you were just at like 15, 20 years and gold has like this thousands of years to mature as a monetary asset. And as like part of the Bitcoin optical illusion or trying to make sense of what's actually happening is because of the pace, like in the grand scheme of human civilization, how fast this thing is actually being adopted. You guys have been watching it with such, you know, it's such an in-depth level for so long. What are some sort of key trends that you would say are the things that you think would make that 50% plus or minus like an achievable, like what will drive that outcome?
Yeah. And do you want to take that one or?
So, It's an interesting question, right? Because at the end, for us as researchers and as a fund, we're always trying to understand what Bitcoin is fundamentally, right? So it's always, we can always talk about it as a base asset, as a macro asset, like gold is, right? And I think gold is probably the last real, let's say, macro asset that has been there before Bitcoin. But I think Bitcoin is not just that, right? It is in its own right, a complex system. It's a system that has, you know, network participants and these participants interacting with each other that create negative and positive externalities, right? Both on a, let's say, on a physical level with mining, but also I think on an interaction kind of cultural level, right? So you have people, for instance, in Argentina that use it on a utility level to bypass or used to, let's say, in Brazil and Argentina to bypass monetary restrictions. And at the same time, you have its use case as well in the developed world for more of a kind of an investment speculative asset, right? So you've kind of this juxtaposition between two things that are creating kind of different facets of this new macro asset that we define as Bitcoin. And I think what's really interesting with every kind of new asset type is that it always has its own characteristics, right? It's kind of like 80% similar to everything else, but then there's that 20% that makes it super unique and super different. And that's actually one of the reasons that us, I think also together with Willy Wu, really wanted to really understand the network, right? To really understand on-chain, understand how the system works, to then actually be able to define what Bitcoin is. Because Bitcoin is not a digital asset. It's not digital gold, right? I think that's kind of selling it short in a big way. It is a lot more than that. It's a base layer for a redefinition, reinventing the stack of value, right? And value, like with the two preceding examples, can be anything, right? It can be something that is much more utility-based. It could be speculation. So I think to understand how that evolves into the future, I think we're still in the very early beginnings, right? To Willy's point, I see that as well. I see it taking over 50% of everything else because it is so versatile. It is so mercurial in its state. It has, in its, you know, very small existence in terms of years that it has had, arguably, let's say 12 years since it's actually been traded, or I think effectively traded, it has been able to take on so many different facets, right? And it has in each, I don't know if you guys remember the fork wars, right? Where people were trying to kind of replicate value by just copying the underlying protocol. And then people realize that's actually not where the value gets generated. It's actually the trust and the adoption and the fact that you don't need 10 different Bitcoins. You need one that everybody can agree to and trust in the same way kind of that the global economy trusts the dollar, right? So you don't need a dollar, a yen, or everything else. You just need a base asset that everything else gets compared against, right? So I think from that perspective, I think gold, it can even surpass gold. I think I don't see a universe where that won't happen. And I think, but it will take longer, right? Because people tend to underestimate what happens in a year. They tend to overestimate what happens in a year, underestimate what can happen in 10 years. And I think we're still thinking in terms of what monetary value is too linearly. I think Bitcoin opens the door to a much more multifaceted definition of value, which can create all sorts of positive externalities into how we as a culture interpret value.
As we're thinking about how this process is going to unfold, how do you guys imagine, well, you mentioned the possibility of sort of fiat and Bitcoin coexisting for an extended period of time potentially. And that's one that I always kind of struggle with because Bitcoin is something that people tend to not, like, they don't stop understanding it once they've figured out what's going on. And so to me, that suggests that all that needs to happen is a broader diffusion of the understanding. And at that point, the argument for fiat or Bitcoin backed fiat is going to get less and less exciting. So how do you imagine that scenario playing out?
You know, fiat has been around, before, and that's always disappeared. And I'd say, 1971 to now, it's a very, very short amount of decades that it's been in existence in this experiment, and it hasn't collapsed yet. And I think part of that is if you look at deep back in, historical times when fiat kind of, was the end result of debasing a society's currency. It was always in isolation and other countries were still on gold or silver or some commodity standard. And so that country would just debase itself to oblivion. But what we have right now is the first global experiment in fiat where you can't run anywhere if you hold fiat. All the countries have weakened themselves with debasing currencies, right? And so sure, some of them mismanage and they hyperinflate, but ultimately, fiat this time around got globally rubbed, right? With Bretton Woods that standardized and centralized all of the gold into Fort Knox, and the US would be the proxy to swap and convert to gold, right? And so when you get that centralization, it's very precarious because all you have to do is get a president like Nixon to say, look, we're going to stop convertibility, and bang, everyone's linked to the US dollar, but it's not linked to gold, right? So that centralization is really, really problematic. If we back dollars and currencies with Bitcoins, like a kind of a rebirth gold standard, it's very, very difficult to rub it in the same way, right? Because it's very decentralized. Everyone holds the underlying asset. It's custody everywhere, and we have a live audit of where it's clustered. We don't have to audit Fort Knox, never have, but we can audit it in real time, every 10 minutes as a block comes out. And so they're still pretty robust when you think about that. And ultimately, if it gets big enough, there's no point in backing. I don't think there's any point in backing, a currency with Bitcoin because it's flexible enough to be indivisible enough and transportable enough at the speed of light across the world in milliseconds on Lightning Network. To be serving as the front end interface. We use notes because the gold's kind of hard to ship around the world, and then we used computers to digitize those notes, and that's our money today. But so I don't think it's a bad thing. I think that ultimately it can lead to, that could be an interim step before moving to a proper Bitcoin standard. Yeah. The question is, for me, is when the whole world's on fiat, how long can that persist for? How long can it persist when the whole world is on fiat? And what we're seeing now are the small nations who've got nothing to lose, back to the war with IMF, and they can take these risky bets. Certainly, if you're the US, you're not going to take the risky bet, right? Because you got everything to lose. So when enough small countries have adopted Bitcoin as a monetary asset, then the fiat world can flee into these other jurisdictions, sovereign jurisdictions that have got hard money. They will grow and prosper, and therefore you can have the shift. That's my opinion anyway. I think that the reason why we've been on fiat so long is because everyone's on it and you've got nowhere to run to. But right now you can, there's starting to be pockets like El Salvador and many others that are starting to stack it, and maybe they will flick it over to the like a legal tender, so to speak, use it as money and pockets. You know, like we've seen Lugano doing this experiment in Switzerland, even cities, you know, that within, you know, democracies that have been able to take Bitcoin, even though the country hasn't accepted that yet. And so that's how I see it anyway.
And I think there's also a point to be made that, you know, good money eventually will always crowd out bad money, right? So it's kind of a concept, maybe you've heard of it, Gresham's Law. You had it even in ancient Greece, right? When they were running their wars with Sparta, where they basically start debasing, adding, you know, other metals into their gold coins, right? So basically in the middle, right, where you couldn't see it. And I think that's always going to be something that is going to happen in the future. But I think what's also important is that Bitcoin gives an alternative. And I think that's one of the key things that a lot of sovereign entities, especially the ones that Will mentioned, that are more trying to grow their economies, their GDP, by, you know, competing in the international scene, by actually being able to actually export, let's say, their culture and their underlying way of doing things, Bitcoin provides a base for that, right? It provides an alternative way of operating that is more flexible. And I think this is always super important because it means that you create a system that allows for to basically keep the incumbents in check. Right. To give an example of this as well, I think with Starlink is one example, right? Starlink is obviously a massive innovation. I think it's a 10x better product than most of the telecom services that can be provided in terms of broadband internet. But I think it's not going to crowd out everything everywhere. But what it will do is that it will definitely basically crowd out or eliminate the really inefficient competitors that have basically been running monopolies or oligopolies, right, in their local zones. And I think Bitcoin is the same to money. Now, how that is actually going to progress into the future remains to be seen. What we have definitely seen, and I think the real impact that it has had, is that it's a super sensitive, like between our circles, we call it a liquidity transfer mechanism, because it is a super sensitive asset to changes in liquidity expectations. At the base, that is what it is in a macro sense, right? If you look at it from a kind of macro construction sense of a portfolio or kind of from that perspective. And what that basically means is that it's very sensitive to manipulations in currencies that are basically deviating from the baseline. As Will mentioned, it's a kind of a race to the bottom. As fiat becomes less and less or more debased, it's a race to the bottom, because at some point people are going to realize that, you know, the savings and the trust in the system, which savings are a way for people to trust in the system and the underlying thing that they're living in. Once that becomes a problem, then people will look for alternatives. And I think that's where Bitcoin will shine. So to Willie's point, the more people abuse, the more powerful Bitcoin becomes. It is there to keep things in check.
In thinking about, you mentioned some of the smaller nation states and cities, we've also sort of entered into a period of what seems to be acceleration of corporate treasury adoption. Your guys' thoughts on that trend in general? Is this good for Bitcoin? What companies should be thinking about a treasury strategy? And what do you think the next, like, 2 to 5 years looks like in the treasury space?
Well, Michael Saylor has shone away and found a way to open up a big black hole to suck in the bond market and funnel it into Bitcoin. You know, the reason why he can do that is in the backdrop of two different systems. You know, we have a Bitcoin system and we have a risk-free rate there. And TradFi, there's a risk-free rate set by the Fed, right, and treasury bonds. And that is presently around 4%. And Bitcoin, depending on how you define the risk-free rate, you know, it's pretty risk-free when you hold the bearer asset and it's just going up by 20-30% per year. You got like 4% versus 20-30%. And right now, since, you know, the last cycle, these two worlds have been merging. You know, the herd is coming while it's here now. And this is just turbulence of some crazy, batshit crazy stuff happening, right? And you're seeing all of this capital flowing into Bitcoin through these treasury companies, and they're doing crazy things like thus ATMing, they're selling and diluting their stock. The stock price goes even higher, right? That's absurd. Why? Because they're buying the underlying asset of Bitcoin, which is climbing even higher. And so there's different economics, different calculations. And, you know, I was saying within our fund, you know, if you're trying to just get USD yield in crypto markets, you could probably get a good 20%, maybe 30%, if you're really good, 15% at a base. That's just doing market neutral yields where you're transporting liquidity between different markets because it's, you know, underpriced or underserved. There's people wanting to buy this asset. So you provide that and you transport it from another market. Like the basis trade is one where you short the futures because everyone wants to go long and paper bet. So you provide the shorts and you buy the spot and you're basically transporting liquidity. All this sort of stuff is produces about 15 to 30% return. And what you could do here is do the same thing in a Bitcoin fund, right? Which is one of the things that we're doing, right? You create a Bitcoin fund and you just do this. You do the transport liquidity, blah, blah, blah. And you can get, you know, say Bitcoin, it's less high yield because it's a volatile asset, just the way the trades work. Maybe you get 5 to 15% yield. That's 5 to 15% more Bitcoin in your stack. And you wrap that thing and you put it into the bank because the bank's now accepted as hedge fund wrappers. You know, it's a security. It's a share in a hedge fund that's yielding. It's just like a share in MicroStrategy, but it's in more private markets. You put it there and they'll give you a loan against that collateral. What do they give you the loan at? Just above the risk-free rate, maybe 4, 5, 6%, right? And your fund is stacking 10% more Bitcoin per year. So suddenly you just get this Bitcoin, you throw it in these wrappers, you know, TradFi a bit. And what works out is your Bitcoin pays off your mortgage, your house in 3 years, all right? Because the risk-free rates are different and you're borrowing TradFi money and you're shoving into this system that's outperforming it massively. And suddenly your Bitcoin's working for you and it's just Bitcoin. And so like Michael Saylor's done this thing, we're doing this other thing, but everyone's following these formulas. And I figure we've got maybe 5, maybe 10 years before these systems start to balance out. You know, our rates start to drop. You know, Bitcoin is declining in gains. The volatility is compressing. The juice in these trades are reducing. And the thing's going to balance and we won't have these treasury companies working like this we see in, you know, 2025 anymore. The opportunity is now. While everything's out of whack, I think that there's danger in these treasury companies. You really want to look at the details around their convertible debt when they mature and actually how high they're trading against their MNAV. Like, because if you're like trading at, say, 8 times the amount of Bitcoins you've got in there and you're trying to sell convertible debt, well, these guys won't convert to shares. They'll want their money back. If Bitcoin doesn't rise high enough in this their convert window, and if it's already trading 8 times, it's well overvalued right now because everything's frothy, and if that froth starts to drop, then these guys are going to have to sell their Bitcoins and they're going to get liquidated. So you want to look at those terms. I think that there's so much of a rush. Some people can take more risks than others to grow faster. Stacking more Bitcoins, but you know, not everyone's going to be on the same sort of risks as, you know, like I would say MicroStrategy is one of the lowest risk companies out there. Very bulletproof debt structuring, very low MNAVs compared to other ones. And so it'll survive pretty nicely through a bear market. I think these MNAVs are going to compress massively in a bear market. And so if you're trading 8 times on an MNAV, and then you reach the top of the market, that probably will go closer to 1 or even dip below it, like MicroStrategy showed in the last bear market. All the while, Bitcoin's pulling back in value. So, you know, we had an 85% decline in Bitcoin from top to bottom in the last bear market. Maybe it's only 50% this time. Well, if the MNAV drops from 8 to 1, you've gone to 12.5% of its value. And then you got a half Bitcoin, so it's gone to, you know, 6.25% of it. So you've dropped 95%, let's say 95, around numbers, 95% of your investment value if you buy at the top of these things. So they're juicy right now because it's frothy, but wait till the beer market. It could be a lot of blood on the streets. I think about people like companies like Metaplanet who are getting a massive high in there, massive rush to buy huge amounts of Bitcoin. And why? Because there's a 40% tax, Bitcoin gains, but that's not the same for equity. So they put an equity wrapper on it. And so all the people who want Bitcoin in Japan, they're piling into Metaplanet. And so, you know, there's going to be a lot of people that potentially could get hurt in the bear market given their NAVs so high. So that would be my word of warning. I know a lot of Bitcoiners are like kind of a little bit concerned about the rush of all of these treasury companies. It's kind of like the new ICO boom. So yeah, that's all I'd say. It's clever what MicroStrategy's done. I think that he's taking the proper amount of risk. I think he's built a pretty bulletproof institution, but you've got to look at every one of these holdcos, you know, treasury companies on their own terms. And I haven't really seen anyone look deeply into the convert debt. How many have converted their risk of liquidations, analyzed the MNAV, the incentives to convert, where Bitcoin price is going. You know, there's a whole lot of work in that to figure out, in my view, the best ones to short in the next bear market. So, you know, it's great right now, but let's see what happens when the markets turn.
But at the same time, we want, you know, heterogeneous systems, right? So we want everybody to be able to participate. Think of them like as layers, right? So you had the early on speculation layer, the first movers that we had during our time when we started in you know, 2012 to 2014. Then you got kind of the next layer, right? Of more kind of really avant-garde hedge funds, maybe some really sophisticated family offices started to invest. Got into the ETF, now it's treasuries, and we're definitely going to go on to sovereign, and they're definitely sovereign investments, but probably also sovereign debt, right? That then gets actually anchored to a ledger like Bitcoin. I mean, it probably will be Bitcoin because it usually follows the power law. But we want to see that progression because that's exactly what you would expect in terms of maturity of an asset class as the investor starts to realize how to position the asset within a larger constructive assets within our portfolio. So I'm very optimistic with that. But as Will said, I think we have to always balance it out with, you know, not going too far out into the greed curve or part of the curve. Because I think, let's say the tail whip on the back end of that can be very severe. So I think volatility is something that you always have to control. And I think that's something I think Scott will talk about in a minute as well, right? That you, especially I think within crypto, you have to be very conscious about volatility. So it's not always about momentum and trend, but it's understanding how to normalize that within a volatility perspective, right? Of really understanding that this asset class has a, you know, 80% implied vol, which is insane, right? Compared to anything else that is out there. Granted that the last couple of years from a macro perspective have been wild. I mean, even treasuries, you know, have been kind of off of the rocker, to kind of use Will's vernacular there. But yeah, this is one of those things I'm super interested to see how this progresses. But I do think that, you know, treasuries and companies wanting to hold it as an asset within their treasury is a massive step in that direction. Something I would have never even dreamed about, I think, 10 years ago, right? When we were still struggling, even getting accepted within a normal banking scenario.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, because like we haven't really seen too much. It's kind of popping out in announcements now, particularly post-Bitcoin conference, you know, different countries are now stacking. And I think it was a conversation with Jan in the last cycle. Because, you know, Jan, being one of the founders of SwissBlock, gets a very, very good insight to what was really happening behind the scenes. I think he said like over a dozen sovereigns were stacking. And, you know, because, you know, I would describe, you know, SwissBlock is the probably one of the most OG crypto Bitcoin trading firms in our industry that no one's heard of, because it's very Swiss and it's very proprietary and private. But I, you know, back in the last cycle, it was the very big name brand global macro funds, when, you know, Bitcoins were starting to get noticed, was SwissBlock they came to, you know, get their notes on it and look at exactly how does this new emerging global macro asset respond to markets. And so they've had a really good early view of what's coming, including eyes on some of these larger sovereigns. So I thought it's very valuable to have his insights on what's really happening behind the scenes within the institutions. So yeah,
it was actually very interesting. This is back in early 2021 when things really started to move. You saw this shift in basically people going from being very kind of hands-offish on Bitcoin to then really switching completely and saying, okay, we really care about Bitcoin now. We're going to be hands-offish with altcoins and Ethereum, right? So they kind of just shifted a peg further in this evolution of adoption, right? As people, you know, kind of have the classic first they fight you, then kind of, you know, and then you win right at the very end. I don't remember how the progression works exactly, but it was super interesting. And you're kind of seeing it's always layers, right? So these things don't just kind of come in a binary sense. You kind of have the first wave come, then it subsides, and then the next wave comes with an additional kind of layer on top, right? So it's new institutions plus, you know, more conservative treasury investors, whatever it ends up being. Then that kind of subsides, and the next wave comes with pulling the older, kind of more conservative elements of the original waves into it as well, right? So that is what creates a big kind of snowball effect that then you can't stop anymore. Because once the cat's out the bag, once there's a major way of accepting things and a standard, which is really the key thing, then you can really start moving along. I think to explain and to really understand how to position this asset class in whatever, you know, form you want to perceive it, you need to have a standard. And I think one of the things that will and ourselves want to propose through Bitcoin Vector is to really re-engage in really defining what that standard is. Because I'm honestly sick and tired of hearing digital gold. I think that's a absolute misnomer, does not characterize what's really actually happening on a more foundational level. And I think we really have to understand this through the looking glass of a much more dynamic and multifaceted value system, right? So this is not, you know, linear like it used to be where I give you a piece of cash, I get asset, right? But much more interlinked, much more dynamic, much more foundational. And I think this is really what the key point is.
You guys have talked about the potential for 90% Bitcoin dominance. Jan, you were mentioning there a few, you know, this has come up a few times in the course of the conversation, the thinner liquidity in the altcoin space and the broader recognition of larger players moving away from, you know, Ethereum and other assets to really have this sort of emerging position that Bitcoin is something different. Could you maybe comment a little bit about that? You know, what does that look like? Where does this go?
So I think Bitcoin is likely to have already won, right? So we keep maybe for some of your older OG listeners, you at the very beginning, say in the early kind of 2012, 13, 14 era, there was this massive kind of debate really about what Bitcoin is and when the killer feature would come, right? And I think we are obviously going to have new things, anything new innovations that will propel things forward. But the real 10x improvement, which is really what we're after, and that is actually required for a system to truly change to a new paradigm, because it's so much better that the opportunity cost of not switching becomes a real problem. I think that war or that struggle has already been done. And I think it got culminated with the forking wars, right? That we had back in, say, 5, 6, 7 years ago, whenever it was. So Bitcoin is established as the anchor asset. So whatever this new emerging system is going to be, that is going to be intermingled, by the way, with the old system. I'm not saying that we're going to completely sideline the incumbents, but it's going to be more of a mixed balance system that key for checks and balances, which I think is massively important. I think the fiat system is very good for certain things, very bad for others. I still use a credit card, not exclusively. Actually, mostly use credit cards because it's very efficient for certain day-to-day types of operations. But when it comes to the actual 10x better, I think the killer features have already been done. It's Bitcoin and arguably also stablecoins. And I think you're going to see that wave now of stablecoin adoption come through. And I think that's the real Trojan horse that is actually going to infiltrate itself into the financial system. So I think when it comes to those two things, that's where most of the interest lies from those early large macro funds that were interested in this in 2020. It was already the first, let's say, innings of that discussion. And now like it's consolidated with the way that banks are actually approaching this, right? So everybody's talking, you know, Bitcoin as a asset, as a hard kind of digital gold version kind of asset, and then stablecoins as a way to actually interact and do things in a more effective way, right? So it could be inter-country remittances, whatever that ends up being, right? So lowering the cost, being 10 times better and much more efficient, which is exactly what we want. How Ethereum and DeFi fits into all of this, I think, remains to be seen. I think DeFi has managed to kind of at least put the question to the forefront of, you know, can we create a system that eliminates middlemen, which I think is a very interesting kind of global proposition that I think needs to be done to improve and I think make things 10x better on the financial system. But I think what Bitcoin and stablecoins propose are an even bigger kind of multiplier, right? When it comes to the value add. But yeah, so most of the discussions to kind of answer the question is around Bitcoin. I would say 10-15% are on Ethereum, but most of them Bitcoin and stablecoins.
You can also just, again, look forward 20 years and run total addressable market. And even in today's value, world GDP at 110 trillion, let's say Bitcoin reaches that 100% sort of equal amount of GDP, amount of what GDP is. In today's dollars, that would be over 100 trillion. And then you can just go run this analysis, ask Grok or ChatGPT and say, what's the total addressable market of, you know, decentralized finance, altcoins, GameFi, altcoins? Remove stable coins because I feel like that's like digitized fiat, right? But run that. And it turns out it's like maybe 10 trillion, 15 trillion on the optimistic side. Let's call it 10 trillion, including gaming, you know, like to give you an idea, all of the financial companies, finance companies, all the PayPals of this world, the banks and so forth, the finance sector of the world economy in equity value is $5 trillion. And so if it can kill all of that, which, you know, I don't think it will. I think it's got its place, but I think it'll be a hybrid. It'll capture some of that market, capture some of the GameFi and, you know, Internet of Things. It's 10 trillion. So it's very simple. It's 10 times versus 100. It's 90% dominant. And, you know, I have this conversation. I kind of work in a asset management firm, which cut its teeth on crypto VC. And I keep telling them, run that equation. Bitcoin has 50x growth in it. Run the equation on altcoins. That entire sector, even if you're picking a winner, the whole sector's not 50x. It's 10x. So the growth of Bitcoin here to the next 20 years, bearing in mind a venture capitalist has a 10-year window per fund, right? And so they need to take this into account, is that the growth is all in Bitcoin and the dominance will go to 90%. You know, I'm not going to time this and say, you know, it's going to trade up and down and it's going to be volatile, but that'll be the trend. And we've seen that cycle pass. I mean, actually, in my view, this is the way I look at it. You know, anyone who's traded altcoins knows that there's these pumps and there's a dump and then it slowly dies, you know, because there's this inflated hyper sort of, you know, what do you call it? The sort of hype around it. And everyone thinks it's going to take over the world. And then there's kind of a plateau approach near the end, right? But it comes down. And 2017 was that hype, you know, Ethereum, the flippening, all this sort of stuff. And you can look at it. It's like it pumped and it dedicated. Each cycle since it has not bounced and measured in Bitcoin terms is high. And every cycle, it's been a new narrative to readjust it. Like the first one was Ethereum, it's real estate, digital real estate, it's going to open the internet, it's going to be, you know, gobble up everything. The next one was decentralized finance, it's going to gobble up everything. And the next one was screw all those VCs who are pumping and dumping and all those founders who are dropping into tokens and it's been printed out in a year. We're going to do our own with no VCs dumping on us. And that's the meme coin. Each one's a different narrative, but you can see each cycle, people getting smarter to what's really real and what is the real productivity. And obviously the traditional world knows that the Bitcoin is real and it's already won and that's where the capital is flying into. And then we just need to see how this technology develops. I know that it's promising. I know also that these massive amounts of hacks, North Korea must love DeFi. You know, they're making billions from these hacks. And it's going to be, it's kind of like even today, it's like Mt. Gox years, 2013. It took a decade for us to get exchanges that weren't constantly rugging us. It might take 10 years for this DeFi stuff to get to maturity, you know. But right now, it's bleeding edge. And the end game is for DeFi, maybe it's $5 trillion if they win all of the finance sector, which is pretty small next to Bitcoin. So
it comes down to the 10x. If it's 10x better, people will adopt it, right? So it's a question of just being better, and opportunity costs to be so high that you have to switch. You have to be part of the initiatives. And I think something will have to break through. But I think to Will's point, and I think this is something that we really want to underline on the Bitcoin Vector as well, is that it really comes down to understanding managing Bitcoin, understanding when that strength, which by the way is 90% of the times it's Bitcoin strength, it's basically market beta, right? That drives even altcoins, arguably over the last 12 months, February being the last one last year, where we actually had relative beta. So the actual real altcoin strength coming through the system. There's arguably, I think, a pocket of or a situation now where that's going to repeat. Reason being that Ethereum is for the first time actually having a lot of relative strength. There's a reignition, a narrative around it, I think, which in part is driven by inflows from ETFs, from BlackRock and these other ETF providers. But I think it's also idiosyncratic to the system. And I think what we really, I think, need to get under wraps, I think when we talk about defining what Bitcoin is to really understand Bitcoin from an on-chain perspective. So I think building on what Will very elegantly did back in the day with his newsletter. And I think really adding that understanding of price, right? Because now that it became not only a investor's game, but an actual traders and, to Will's point, really sophisticated space where people are adding this and looking at the asset in terms of how they can position it within their way of operating, their way of making returns within their portfolio. It is about risk management and it is about understanding volatility. It's really merging those two things together, kind of the expertise on chain plus the expertise that comes from, you know, 10 years of systematic trading in this space, and combining that together in a simple, easy to understand framework that defines what Bitcoin is. And more importantly, gives you an understanding of when that rotation to altcoins actually matters, because it has idiosyncratic strength. And those opportunities are, you know, far in between. It's only 10% of the times that you actually see Ethereum fundamentally outperforming over a 2-3 month period versus Bitcoin, and especially altcoins, right? And I think we list this out as well in our research, but it's super important to keep that in mind. So holding a altcoin portfolio for a prolonged period of time is a very bad thing from a portfolio perspective, because you're just ingesting massive amounts of downside vol. So our number one point about talking about standards and understanding it is that understand Bitcoin. Because once you understand Bitcoin, everything else becomes a consequence.
Hey everyone, quick question. Have you ever thought about starting a video podcast like this one? I want to introduce you to the team behind my show, Podigy. This podcast has been one of the best marketing tools for our business. And thanks to Podigy, all I have to do is hit record. They handle everything else, editing, writing, publishing, and making sure that it's perfectly optimized for every platform. They only work with disruptors, mavericks, and changemakers, people making a real difference, spreading big ideas. Typically, Podigy is fully booked, but right now they have a few spots open for new clients. Listeners of this show get 10% off launching their own podcast or optimizing their current one. Click the link in the bio for a free one-on-one podcast planning session with Podigy. If you are thinking about starting a podcast or you have one and you want to take it to the next level, I can't recommend Podigy enough. Check them out.
I'd love to ask you guys one more question before we sort of shift into Swiss Block. This has come up again a few times in the conversation, this idea about volatility compression. How do we think about or reconcile a massive future global market cap for Bitcoin, and at the same time, the potential for, you know, smaller and smaller cycles, or, you know, where do you guys sit on that? And, you know, what's your opinion of, is our blow off tops kind of over? And how do we get to a 10 million Bitcoin without having some kind of acceleration? Like for me, this is kind of always one of the things I wonder about Sailor's, you know, 20, 50 Bitcoin prices. I have a hard time understanding how an asset could continually be outperforming everything else by 20 or 30% and have it take 20 years for the rest of the world to really figure out what's going on. So what are your guys' thoughts around the sort of like medium, you know, 5 to 15 year trend in Bitcoin volatility?
Before Will gives his answer, I'll divide into two things. I'm more interested in the path and how we get there, because I think we will get to some version of that. But I think we need to always kind of superimpose that with investment mentality versus trading mentality, right? So I think what Saylor doesn't talk about is how do you risk manage your way to that point, right? Because doing a round trip of, like Will said, go down 90% go up 100 or 200%. It's not a very good existence, I think, as a from an investment perspective as well, and doesn't really lend itself to an effective asset that can be put into a 401k or something along those lines. So I just wanted to kind of, I think the path matters. And I think we don't talk enough about the path, because I think everybody's talking about these lofty, crazy, you know, moonshot ideas, but nobody's really thinking about, okay, so how do we actually get there? What's the sort of plumbing, the infrastructure, the educational side of really getting, the banking system on board and understanding what this is, how they need to manage it, and how you can balance out the downside risks, right? Which is basically volatility. And the reason everybody says just buy 50 basis points or a small percentage in your portfolio is because they're basically telling you buy it because it's asymmetric, but I don't know how to manage the volatility. So kind of buy a little bit. I think that's really the wrong question. It's always should be proportionate to what everything else is doing, right? So when you have debasements, when you have M2 going through the roof, you should be disproportionately allocated to an asset that is sensitive to liquidity, right? Expectations specifically. When that is not the case, you probably shouldn't, right? And I think it's about understanding context more than being exclusive. It's Bitcoin and nothing else. I think that's kind of too much of a dystopian way of looking at investments.
Yeah, I mean, if the question is how do we get there in the path? And a little bit like on Jan's side is, what does that path look like in its structure and shape and underlying? If you look at Bitcoin cycles and overlay global liquidity, which is a fancy word for money printing, and how money's flowing through central banks to, you know, the other side of the trade, it's always pumped when there's more M2, there's more fiat in the system. It's like the smart investors run to Bitcoin and it grows. And in 2013 cycle, 2017 cycle, you know, that was aligned to a fresh batch of money liquidity injected into the system. They were very special. We'll never get those again. They were exponential runs. The reason why they're exponential runs is we did not have derivative markets for Bitcoin. So what that means was that if I want to buy Bitcoin right now and I've got the FOMO and it's running up in price, you know, 10% gains per month or week, or once it doubled in a week, who's going to sell it to me? Well, you know, the only those OGs that bought it, you know, back in the day, they're the only ones with Bitcoin that's going to sell to you. It's got to be worth their while. So the whole thing runs up exponentially. You'd see that in altcoins as well. And then you'll notice that the next cycle after that was the 2020 into 21 cycle, and it was a rounded, right? It wasn't an exponential blow off. It was a rounded top. And if you looked at the data underneath that, what was happening here? Well, we had the CME come in, BitMEX was invented. We had all the competitors to BitMEX. Binance were trading pretty large amount of open interest in paper. So there was all these futures bets, the perpetual swap, counters, futures, options markets. You could now front some dirty fiat, right? In our world, dirty fiat. And it says, I'm going to sell you that Bitcoin through a paper contract. I will just front my fiat, of which I have infinite. You're for global macro fund, you've got billions of fiat. You know, you're looking for good trades. This could carry a lot of trade. You know, it's decent sized volume in the trade. So I think it's overheated. It's going exponential. It's got a mean revert. So you just sell that. So suddenly there's all this paper that's in the system that's absorbing the Bitcoin demand, because not everyone wanted the real Bitcoin. They just wanted exposure to it. I know the hedge fund, the retirement fund in New Zealand, one of the Pi Savers, there was a manager that bought the futures for his fund. Why? Because custody is a problem. There wasn't the ETF, the spot ETF. The only vehicle he could do, even legally, was buying it on a regulated exchange on the CME. So all these institutions that were buying access to it were buying paper, and suddenly one could sell paper into it with backing it with dollars. And so the structure completely changed, right? And we, in my world, like we run a fund of funds. We track around 700 managers that are trading within digital assets. And like these are, you know, vast majority of them are trading directionally. And they're doing it really badly, like terribly. They make money and then they lose a lot and then they shut down. And the reason for that, in my opinion, is that they've overfitted their strategies to a past structure of our market. And our market changes every so many months. There's like, what happens when the CME launches? What happens when the ETF comes in? What happens when, you know, the spot ETF? What happens when there's another, like, say, the Hyperliquid DEX that's getting, you know, interesting volume now? And so every so many months, there's a new thing, and it all impacts the market, and it all screws around with your fitting what your strategy is. And so, like, all of them go kaput mainly. Like, I would say 95% are not investable, and unlike SwissSwap, which do it right now. So where does the path go is that this market's going to get more and more sophisticated. And I posted last cycle, probably one cycle too early. This is the last cycle, meaning the internal forces within Bitcoin, which is the halving, the supply shock every 4 years, is now kind of meaningless, right? The inflation rate is less than gold right now, and that'll halve, but it doesn't make much impact compared to the demand side, which is the microstrategies of this, where the sovereign buying it and global investors buying it under M2 sort of liquidity. And so it will be just another global macro asset, and then it'll do a random walk without these large swings in due time. Maybe it's not this cycle, maybe that once we get 85%, we get a 50% pullback. Maybe we get a 30%. Eventually, you know, it won't look like these crazy 85% pullbacks in proper bear markets we've seen. But the trajectory is the same, right? You just saw that, you know, everyone's seen the rainbow, the happy rainbow chart, right? Look at the curve on that and see where it goes. And all we're doing is a random wiggle, and there used to be big swings, and it's sort of less now, the ripples. But it gets there, right? It gets there. Not in 10 years, maybe 20.
Cycles change, to your point. None of them have been similar to the previous one. It's been, it's basically the market trying to figure out what this is, right? So going back to kind of the layer idea, right? Of kind of each swell that comes through subsides, it creates more complexity, becomes more complex, more diverse, which I think brings inherent robustness, right? Because it means that if a certain cohort starts selling, another one is probably starting to buy, right? So you have this more natural cycle between how kind of liquidity and how money moves through the system, which I think is massively important. And I think when it comes to blow off tops, Scott, I think it really depends on what you mean by this, because I think you're always going to have speculation. You're always going to have people that are overestimating, kind of going back to the concept that we talked about in terms of overestimating short-term, underestimating long-term viability. I think that mismatch, that, you know, misbalance is always going to be there. But I think there's many more tools now to be able to kind of extract that inefficiency out of the market, right? So I think there's a lot of sophistication around, I think, in the system that it prohibits, you know, kind of a 2017 type of situation, unless you have a macro backdrop that is basically going off of the rockers. Again, going back to the point that Bitcoin is a mechanism that keeps the incumbents in check, right? So if the incumbents start printing like crazy, then absolutely gold, potentially Bitcoin, you know, is definitely going to kind of counterbalance that, at which point you would have a blow off top type of situation, right? Where everybody crowds into the trade in a very short period of time. You get a massive dislodge in the supply-demand dynamics, and then you basically create the blow-off top type of scenario. Now, how persistent that can be, it remains to be seen. I think we are getting closer and closer to that debt jubilee type of situation, something that Raoul Powell proposed a couple of years back. I think there's many things that are going to happen on the way to that. I think a lot of cracks and breaks in the system, and it's going to be interesting to see how Bitcoin absorbs that, how it counterweighs those inefficiencies and that kind of lack of clarity, right? Which, to Will's point, is at the foundations of any system, you lose trust. Trust means that you stop interacting. Once you stop interacting, the system contracts. So for us, it's super important that Bitcoin, for it to keep thriving, you know, that you are absorbing and pulling inefficiencies from other places where, you know, people, you know, are mistrusting, not really understanding kind of how things are working, into a scenario that is a lot more transparent and really fungible as well, right? For many.
That's probably a great segue into the work that you guys are doing at SwissBlock and with the Bitcoin Vector. And so what should our listeners sort of understand about what's available in the tools and resources and services you guys offer?
Yeah. So we've built, I mean, to Will's point, right? We've been doing this now for more than 10 years and we've been hyper-focused, obsessively focused on understanding cycles. Will was one of the OGs, right? So he was one of the founding fathers of on-chain and analytics. We kind of piggybacked on a lot of his work to create what is now known as Glassnode, kind of been an integral part of that, really understanding what makes this asset different, right? So you can always talk about the fact that you have an exchange, order book, right? How this is similar to other assets, but like how are the apples and oranges different as well, right? And I think that's where the on-chain analytics became super important because that was that 20% that made Bitcoin unique and a completely different thing from the beginning. So it was super important to understand it. And also at the end, I always look at Bitcoin as an elastic band, right? It's a system that stretches and contracts based on how resources get shared and consumed within the system, right? So you have always this kind of juxtaposition or this balance between network growth, so new entrants into the market, old incumbents that are basically interacting with each other, which is basically how we define liquidity. And then going from there, understanding, okay, based on those levels of interactions, based on how frequent and how constant those are, what can you talk about? What can you interpolate in terms of the system? Like how far can those interactions go until, to Will's point, the old guys start saying, hey, this is now 10x from where I bought. I'm going to start selling, right? Because it's too risky. Like I want to buy a house. I want to buy a car, especially the guys that were with us back in the day. They were all in their mid-20s. They're all in their mid-30s now. Expectations change, you know, perceptions about what the value propositions for life changes. And I think you're seeing in the ecosystem as well how that's being kind of threaded into the culture of what the ecosystem is of Bitcoin, right? So I think understanding it from those foundations and then adding the understanding of how to actually trade it, right? So the good thing with SwissBlock is that having had 10 years, we've made all the mistakes that you can possibly think of, including what Will said as well about overfitting, right? So you have this system that goes exponential and then crashes like crazy. How do you manage this in a trend moving, like a trend strategy, right? How do you not overfit to the upside in a way where you capture it to in a big extent, but then don't get destroyed once it actually shifts? And those shifts are not always the same. To Will's point, you know, there's rounded tops, there's basically spiky tops, right? In terms of blow off tops, they all look different. And you need a robust system. I think what we've built over the last 10 years with kind of Will's knowledge, with our knowledge, is something that is foundationally interesting to just understand when you have a top, when you have a bottom that is global, when are those tops and bottoms more local, right? When can you, and by the way, also, when is that weakness in Bitcoin that rotates into alts? And when is that weakness all around where you have to go into cash, right? So what we're proposing is a framework to be able to understand those basics. And then kind of gives people that extra edge to then really kind of expand on what they already know, right? In their way of working and trading, whatever that ends up being.
Yeah, and I'd add to this is like, obviously SwissBlock has been very successful over the 10-year trading record. And Jan approached me. Look, we've worked together, you know, about 5 years now, particularly me, more aligned with Glassnode's work. And he was just saying, look, Global Macro now, StratFi, and they're all coming in and they will want to represent the space. You know, we'll have the Bloombergs, the Morningstars of this world come in and want to be the experts within Bitcoin as it grows into a global macro asset. And we're also seeing that, you know, there's a lot of people that really looking deep enough within our industry to represent what's really going on. And so we thought that it'd be really good to create a premier product that can really demonstrate what is really happening underneath this new, you know, basically the newest macro asset that's landed on the planet in 150 years. And we'd like to represent that with the Bitcoin ethos, understanding where it's come from, what it stands for, and all through the way through into the microstructure of how it trades and how sensitive it is to liquidity, how it interacts with global markets. So we thought that, you know, because, you know, for SwissBlock, I don't think it's really, they're highly successful in what they do. For me, it's like, this is kind of a journey that, you know, both like the good people, but also the ethos of representing Bitcoin from within our industry is very appealing. So So hence we launched the Bitcoin Vector, which is really a institutional grade product that is designed for institutions, family offices, professional traders, and global macro hedge funds. So really kind of a really deep, deep, rich framework that is traded significant capital and is very, very holistic in its view of the market. So we thought we could kind of unite forces. And, you know, I tend to have a way of communicating relatively, you know, in plain English, even though underlying it's quite technical. And so, yeah, well, this is really the idea, is that, well, let's join forces and create a premier product that describes Bitcoin's market and market structures for the professionals.
And also realizing that the best way to increase chances of success, of adoption, it is a question of education. It's a question of understanding what it is and not just kind of, you know, tagging it as digital gold, because I think that does it a disservice in the, I think, the incumbents, right? The players that are dominant in TradFi that are not really understanding what this actually is. I think arguably it's only really been 2 years since they've actually put significant resources and time into really understanding how to position and market this. BlackRock being probably one of the premier kind of, you know, drivers of that wave. But I think the knowledge and the know-how, kind of going back to what Will said a couple of maybe 30 minutes ago about these other macro hedge funds that came to us in the 20s and like 19, 20, 21, is that a lot of what they know and learned kind of directly comes from the research and the work that we did. So I think we think that we're uniquely qualified to, you know, to have a voice and to represent, I think, that definition of what Bitcoin is, and also be part of that kind of bringing and building those bridges of actually allowing TradFi to come in, but I think also within the ecosystem, create standards. Because I think the only way that you can get true adoption is by actually adopting standards. If you have only islands of infighting and people thinking that they know best, then it doesn't really create that integration, doesn't create that, you know, that union that I think we need to be able to actually be a strong front to all the things that are going to come in the future. So I think that's, you know, a big part of the ethos as well.
Guys, I really appreciate you coming on to share this deeply insightful conversation. And we'll include some of these relevant links in the show notes. But is there anywhere specifically we can point listeners to if they want to learn more or find you guys?
Yeah. So there's we have a Twitter handle. It's called Bitcoin Vector, at Bitcoin Vector, that we basically will use just to kind of, you know, post about market movements, changes using the framework, and obviously the insights that Will and I bring to the equation. And then that also links to a website, right, Will? That's probably the best way.
Yeah, it's probably just go on X platform, go to at Bitcoin Vector, and the profile links to the website. And also, you know, there's a group of different handles. There's also Swiss Block, double underscore on the end. It's also like, you know, the parent firm's handle. And Gentropic, which is Yarn's handle, I think. And Yarn, is it two Yarns? Is the other, oh yeah, Yarn Apple as well is posting. These two Yarns, yeah, the two founders are posting from that handle. And obviously my handle is Woonomic. I'll retweet some of that stuff and, you know, post some of the insights on that channel as well.
Thank you again, guys. Yeah.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having us.
Great. And if you're listening and you made it all the way to the end of the episode, I want to thank you as well for tuning in, and hope to see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. BlockRewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. Supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and BMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.